Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us on the phone is Andrew Rosenberg. He's the director with the Center for Science and Democracy as part of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
So before we dive into the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards, tell us about the role of your organization, the Center for Science and Democracy.
Well, Union of Concerned Scientists has been around for 50 years, initially formed by scientists at Harvard and MIT concerned about the Vietnam War and nuclear weapons policy, and then grew into a scientist activist organization. And we fight for science-based policymaking, public policies. And we also encourage scientists to be activists, to speak out and to participate in democracy. And my program is particularly to emphasize the role of science in our democracy, in public policymaking, but also in the public dialogue. This program has been around for 8 years. And so we are fighting misinformation, but also the importance of making policies based on good science, ensuring that the public has the best information available and that scientists are actually involved in democratic dialogue and process.
So as part of this, you're a leader in an organization called the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards. It's a nonprofit that's tracking the rollback of dozens of regulations that are designed to protect human health, environmental health, and other things. When did the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards kind of come together, and can you give us a quick profile of that group?
Coalition for Sensible Safeguards has been around for multiple administrations, at least since the Bush administration, and contains more than 100 groups. Really, the idea is that safeguards, in this case, are the rules that try to keep the public safe. And so everything from unions to conservation groups to science groups to general public interest groups like Public Citizen, Natural Resources Defense Council, those kinds of groups are involved in the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards. Not only does the coalition track what is going on in the regulatory world, but also fights regulatory rollbacks that would harm public health. Regulations can always be made better, but usually better is not removing them.
Sure. And so the rollbacks that you're looking at, you know, today obviously we're going to kind of focus on the environmental side of these things, but it's not just that. You know, as I look at your tracker, there are things about you know, halftime pay calculations and, you know, sexual assault on college campus rules and things like that. So these really span a pretty broad range, right?
They do span an incredibly broad range. I mean, the purpose of regulations really is to serve the public interest, to provide the rules that private interests need to work by to protect the public interest. And there has been a narrative out there that regulations are just a bunch of red tape and are really meaningless, but the regulations are only written pursuant to a specific law passed by Congress and signed into law by the president. And they are designed to protect the public, and that means from abuses on everything from, you know, insurance company abuses or financial industry abuses to environmental abuses, and in particular public health and safety, as we're going to focus on today. And so, you know, unfortunately, that narrative which has been pushed that say regulations are just red tape that put costs on business leaves out the fact that if you don't put them in place, people are at risk and all the costs just fall on the public, as opposed to a business having to deal with any problems that they create.
So the regulations in environmental rubric are associated with, say, air quality, water quality, habitat protection, hazardous waste and chemical management, et cetera. These are regulations that have been established over the decades by different administrations. Let's be fair, by Republican and Democratic administrations. But I'm going to guess that we're seeing an increase, perhaps in these past 4 years, an increase in this quote-unquote rollback of regulations like this.
That's exactly right. And interestingly enough, a lot of environmental regulations stem from the 1970s, and most of the principal statutes, not all of them, that protect public health and safety and the environment were passed during the Nixon administration. So the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, all of these things were passed during the Nixon administration, the Endangered Species Act that it tries to ensure that we don't actually lose species from the planet. And so it has been very much a bipartisan effort. Really, regulations are the things that implement laws. So Congress writes a law and says we want, you know, the water to be fishable and swimmable in the language of the Clean Water Act, or we want to reduce air pollution that harms public health in the language of the Clean Air Act. Well, Congress just saying that doesn't actually take the action. What has to happen then is a federal agency needs to say, translate that into real action. And that's what regulations are. They're the rules that are under specific statutes that Congress has passed and have been signed into law across administrations. This administration has wholly bought into the narrative that regulations are unnecessary. They're just a bunch of red tape. We don't need to take those kinds of actions. And early on, they said that, you know, that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of unnecessary regulations on the books that don't do anything and are just there imposing costs on business. And you know, I asked people for examples. Tell me a regulation that doesn't do anything, is completely unnecessary, and is imposing costs on business. I used to, you know, be a regulator working in the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The only one people could point me to is a regulation on whale oil. They said, oh, that's completely unnecessary. Yeah, but what cost is it imposing on business? None. Yes, it hasn't been removed from the books, but there aren't some big backlog of regulations that don't do anything. Again, you can make regulatory policy better, but that rarely involves removing it.
So let's then talk about some examples of regulations that do have an import, that are critical to air quality, water quality, and you're seeing them being, quote-unquote, rolled back in one form or another.
Air pollution is the greatest example for people to, you know, really get a feel for. You know, the air quality in the United States has improved since the 1970s in a almost continuous decline in air pollution until the last 3 years when air pollution has started to increase again. And that's because this administration has both reduced the real regulations, sometimes by changing them, saying we don't need to make the air cleaner, for example, on things like particulate matter. That's where they're moving to now. And also reduced enforcement of those regulations and told, and, you know, people who are not following the rules that that's okay. They're not going to put penalties in place. There aren't really any consequences for not following the rules. So that air pollution is, you know, things like particulate matter, very fine particulates that get deep into the lungs. But it also includes ozone, which is related to cardiac problems in people with high levels of ozone. Nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, the thing that causes acid rain and so on. We have done a very good job until this administration of slowly reducing that air pollution, but it doesn't mean it's gone away, that there's no more work to be done. And so that's an example of a regulatory rollback, as if we have solved the problems of pollution and no longer need to take any action, which is, again, a narrative that this administration and, frankly, polluting industries in some cases have put out and supported, that says, oh, no, we don't really have these public health problems anymore. They're not issues. We should roll back the regulations.
If you are just joining us, we're speaking with Andrew Rosenberg. He's the director of the Center for Science and Democracy with the Union of Concerned Scientists. And today we're talking about the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards and their pandemic rollback tracker. So, Andrew, let's highlight a couple of the specific rules that have been rolled back since the start of the pandemic this year. Let's just look at the clean car standards, right?
Hmm. Right. Well, so there has been an increase in fuel efficiency for cars that has, you know, been in place for decades now to continue to increase fuel efficiency and reduce pollution. That's an important step to not only conserving energy, but also reducing air pollution. Transportation is the largest contributor to some kinds of air pollution in the country. There was an agreement in place to continue to increase fuel efficiency standards that was passed under the Obama administration. This administration has said, based on a faulty analysis, that that's no longer necessary. We're going to allow cars that are gas guzzlers. In other words, the companies don't have to increase their fuel efficiency at nearly the rate that the Obama administration recommended, that only tiny increases in fuel efficiency, and this is a fleet average fuel efficiency, which is a little bit complicated to think about, but it's the thing that spurred increasing gas mileage in many cars and reduced air pollution. But not only did they slow the increase in required efficiency, but they also are trying to force the state of California not to mandate an increase in fuel efficiency, which is rather interesting because several car companies have actually joined forces with California saying, no, no, we want these higher standards. And other car companies have said, no, we don't. But they don't want to allow the state to say, we believe we need to continue to clean up the air within the state of California. Of course, very large state, and many other states have gone along with the California standards. The rationale for that has been supposedly that cars that are less fuel efficient are safer. But that analysis has been noted to be flawed by many, many independent reviewers, including Union of Concerned Scientists. So it's an example of rolling back a regulation that would benefit the public simply on behalf of not even the entire industry, but only a portion of the industry.
Yeah, let's talk about this term rollback, because sometimes it's
right.
It can be a regulation can be weakened in one form, revoked right. Totally. Maybe even replaced with another regulation. So that's what we mean by roll back in general terms. Who does this? Is it done by Congress? Can it be done by executive order? Are there other means and vehicles of doing these things?
It cannot be done strictly by executive order. It can only be done by Congress passing a new statutory requirement, or by federal agencies working in the executive branch that move forward with a new regulation that is weaker or repeals an old regulation. And this is actually something that was quite interesting, particularly at the start of the administration. The administration coming in seemed to have the sense that they could just roll back or remove a regulation, without going through formal what's called rulemaking. Mm-hmm. So there's something called the Administrative Procedures Act, which says if you're going to put a regulation in place, you have to go through a series of steps, and you have to analyze the impacts of doing that, and you have to involve the public in certain ways. And this administration seemed to think that that didn't apply to them. They could just halt or remove regulations without any full justification. And the courts have said no. As far as I'm aware, the administration has lost more challenges to their regulatory policies than any other administration I've observed. I worked in three. And so, when you so-called roll back a regulation, that means putting a new regulation in place, and you have to go through all of the steps, including justifying why you're doing it, why it is authorized under the statute, under the law, what the impacts will be, why did you take the action. And the key phrase in the Administrative Procedures Act that I referred to is that an agency may not be arbitrary and capricious. In other words, you can't just do it because you feel like it, and you can't do it without justification. And again, the administration has lost in a fairly large number of lawsuits. I believe they've been tracked by the New York Times and also by the Harvard Law School tracker. They've lost a lot of cases because they have been arbitrary and capricious. In other words, they haven't justified their actions. And some of the rules that I've looked at, there's no justification at all. Mm-hmm. They just say the agency proposes to do this, and we're going to move forward, and we invite public comment without any analysis of what the impacts would be if they change the rules.
So since the beginning of the pandemic, you know, who has been motivating this increased number or this, I guess, acceleration of rollbacks? Like, where is that coming from?
Well, unfortunately, I think the administration and certain business interests or special interests have used the pandemic sort of as a cover to shortcut the process of changing the rules. Again, an administration can change the rules if they go through the process and justify it and so on. But groups such as Heritage Action and other conservative business focused groups have actually put out a wish list of things that they want to change, same as they did at the beginning of the administration when President Trump first took office, saying, here's the things we want changed. This is not a haphazard strategy. It followed a very specific playbook that some large industries, particularly the oil and gas industry, have used to try to change the rules and boost their bottom lines because, again, they can shift costs onto the public from their own books. And those costs come in terms of public health, public safety, environmental compliance, enforcement, and so on. So that's been a concerted strategy pushed by, again, the petrochemical industry, fossil fuel industry, and their lobbying groups like the Heritage Foundation and Heritage Action to try to target very specific rules. And not only individual rules, but also the process by which science informs our public policy overall. So they've taken several actions during the pandemic that really completely sidelines the science that should be the basis for protecting public health and safety. And that's something that my program in particular has been fighting very hard on. And so you will see during the pandemic that the administration has announced that they're going to allow industries to basically self-enforce the rules as opposed to monitoring emissions closely. They're going to say, oh, yes, we're monitoring emissions. We're just allowing the industries to report for themselves without any independent checks. Same thing for a whole set of rules around, you know, oil rig safety. You know, we're just going to let industry self-enforce and hold themselves to the standard without having any independent check. And, of course, there's pretty good evidence that self-enforcement in many cases doesn't work very well. There also have been changes to public lands leasing and connection of royalties from oil and gas companies. So the administration said that in order to, you know, boost the economy, we're going to suspend royalty payments to states and the federal government from oil and gas leasing at a time when, you know, budgets are in a critical state. And at the same time that the oil industry was calling for bailout funds because of low oil prices, the administration fast-tracked leasing on public lands of new leases for oil companies. So they were spending $100 million on new leases and essentially asking the federal government for more than that in bailout funds so that the federal government was paying for people effectively to lease new land, new public lands and leasing sites, as well as open up places like Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So again, this is sort of a long wish list from special interests that unfortunately the Trump administration has bought into. And really what we're seeing is an administration that is serving the special interest much more than they're serving the public interest.
And when you say Trump administration, you have to include organizations like the EPA in that.
Oh, yes. What's happened in this administration is that many of the industry lobbyists, what people normally think of as the swamp, as labeled by President Trump, have been brought inside the agency to run the agencies that they were fighting against when they were on the outside. So Andrew Wheeler, who's the head of the EPA, used to be a coal industry lobbyist and also worked for several oil and gas companies. The guy, William Pendley, in the Department of Interior, who runs the Bureau of Land Management, used to be a lawyer and lobbyist arguing that we shouldn't have public lands, that all lands should be in private hands, not public lands. And he now is responsible for the management of public lands, and you can imagine what happens. He has a list that he says he carries around of 60 former clients where he should be recusing himself from any decision-making, but there's no evidence he has been recusing himself from that decision-making. So you've brought the head of the chemical policy at the EPA for a while, now she's been moved up to the White House, was the policy director for the American Chemistry Council, the industry trade group that fights against regulatory policy. That person, Dr. Nancy Beck, was moved inside the EPA to, you guessed it, manage chemical safety policy.
Right.
And surprisingly enough, changed the policies to line up with what industry had asked for as opposed to in the public interest. So, yes, we're talking about pretty much an industry takeover of many government agencies that were that are supposed to be there to serve us, not the industries.
It is a pretty...
And, you know, they were supposed to regulate the industries in the public interest.
It is a pretty astonishing... Sure, yeah, astonishing level of change.
It's frightening. It's quite frightening.
Yeah.
Again, I used to work at NOAA working on, you know, marine resource policy, fisheries, habitat, endangered species, and so on. And so I'm very familiar with regulatory policies and the regulatory process. Never have I seen people move in and take over, essentially, from the industries that are supposed to be regulated, and then really only respond to those industries, not to the public.
Mm. So kind of in your tracking here of these pandemic rollbacks, you've also included kind of a catalog of the calls to action to pause the rulemaking and extend comment periods during this COVID-19 pandemic. So who's speaking up about this right now?
Well, we have made requests to pause rulemaking and to hold off. In particular, there was a rulemaking that's moving forward at the Environmental Protection Agency, which they call about transparency. It would require all of the underlying data, raw data, to be publicly available before the EPA could use it, which sounds nice, and we're in favor of different kinds of transparency. The only problem is that much of the data that the EPA bases its actions on are to protect public health, and personal health data, of course, cannot be released publicly, the actual data on individuals. It shouldn't be released publicly, and it's not needed to evaluate the quality of a study. You don't go back to the raw data to evaluate the study. You look at the methods and the analytical approach and so on. So they call that transparency, but really it was designed by the tobacco industry some years ago to fight off any attempt to regulate secondhand smoke. And it was admitted at the time if they could get this rule in place, it would make it almost impossible for the EPA to regulate anything. Well, this rule particularly targets epidemiological studies, those studies about the effect on the population of different kinds of impacts like pollutants, and exactly the sort of studies that we're using in the pandemic. It basically excludes epidemiological information. They pushed forward with this rule during the pandemic when the epidemiologists are all working trying to fight the pandemic and are struggling to meet their day-to-day workload. let alone comment on a rule at the EPA. So that's taking advantage of, you know, a short comment period. This is a rule that affects all science used at the EPA, and they initially had a 30-day comment period, which is very short. They increased it to 60 days, but generally these kinds of things would have at least 90 days or longer in special circumstances, and I think you could call a pandemic special circumstances.
I agree with that.
These are examples of very, very short comment lines on things that have huge impacts. Another one which is sure to move forward now is changing the way that costs and benefits of rules are calculated, such that you reduce the ability to include different kinds of benefits to the public, but you increase the ability for industries to add costs to the ledger. So most things seem to cost more than the benefits they provide. And there's some complicated technical reasons why they're doing that, but basically they're restricting what can be included in the calculation of benefits to the public by putting certain rules onto industry. And that's going to have a very short comment period during a pandemic when, you know, the people who do this stuff, including my group, are all working from home and so on. Mm-hmm. So it's really a very pernicious and cynical kind of action to make these broad sweeping rules during a pandemic. It's cynical even in the best of times. It's worse during a pandemic.
Right. It's taking advantage of a crisis, right? That's
right.
Typical.
When people are understandably, it's difficult for people to be paying close attention and
right.
respond. And in addition to that, they've used as an excuse that they can't hold public hearings. Normally, when you go through rulemaking, you invite public comment during a comment period, and you hold public hearings, and those hearings should be held in places where, you know, there are concentrations of people who are going to be affected by the rule. Well, they've ignored the first part about holding hearings in places that are, where people affected by the rule are going to be held. For example, they held a hearing on chemical disaster protections in Washington, D.C. Well, that's not where the chemical disasters are happening. That's not where the environmental justice communities are located that are affected by chemical plants. But in addition to that, they've now said, well, we can't hold public hearings because of COVID-19. But they could hold virtual public hearings. And to demonstrate that, when they refused to hold a public hearing on this ruling that restricts the science the EPA could use, my organization said, well, we'll do it for you. And we held a public hearing. We had people attend and testify and provide public comment on the record. We managed to put that together in 2 weeks. And, you know, I have a small staff. EPA couldn't do it with their 25,000 employees. They said it was too onerous for them to hold a public hearing. So they're cutting the public out of the process, too, such that it means only industry voices are the only thing that they hear.
And so we're seeing, you know, as an example, 18 U.S. Senate Democrats have spoken out against rollbacks or called to pause rulemaking or extend comment periods. The U.S. House Committee on Financial Services Democrats, the U.S. House Committee Chairs, 21 State Attorneys General, National Associations of Governors, State Legislators, Legislatures, Mayors, Counties, and Cities, and the list goes on and on. So this isn't going unnoticed, and some of those that are seeing it are speaking out against it.
That's right, and I mean, it's really important that elected officials and appointed officials do speak out against this because it undermines our democracy. It's not a matter of, you know, whether you agree with the rules or not. There is a process that we need to follow that gathers public input, to responds to that public input, makes sure that we've actually analyzed what we think the impacts will be. That shouldn't be a partisan issue at all. You can have different positions on policy, but you should be following a consistent process. And again, this administration has decided that doesn't apply to them. You know, Senator Carper, for example, has you know, issued a report showing how some of these regulatory rollbacks are really harmful to the public. Senator Markey has spoken out about impacts on communities of color and environmental justice communities and so on, which inevitably bear the brunt of many of these loss of regulatory protections. That's where the majority of pollution is. That's where enforcement is weakest. That's where most of the industry is located, in communities of color, indigenous communities and other places. And particularly during the pandemic, many of these kinds of pollution exacerbate the risks from COVID-19 because it's a respiratory disease. So if you increase air pollution, then there's good evidence that shows that that increases the risk from the virus itself, from mortality due to the virus.
All right. So we've seen all of these weakening, revoking, replacing of regulations that, you know, like you say, designed originally to protect our air, our water, our wildlife, et cetera. Let's say that, oh, I don't know, 5 months from now or so, we have a change in administration, let's say. And how easy or difficult might it be then to roll back these rollbacks, to go back, you know, to change these regulations once again? Can they be done simply, or do they require long administrative periods and hearings, et cetera?
So there's two possible avenues here. There actually are three, but let's talk about the first two. One of them is that the administration, of course, is, as you almost always do in regulatory policy, is in court. You know, people who disagree with the policy often file suit, civil suit, and try to stop the rulemaking. Things that are in court, a new administration could determine they don't want to defend the position that the previous administration took. Mm-hmm. The Trump administration did that on several things, including the Clean Power Plan, the rules to make progress to battle climate change. Mm-hmm. So for things that are in court and are currently on hold because of a lawsuit, it may be possible to simply halt those rules moving forward. So the rules might be final, but they might not be implemented yet because a judge has said you can't implement them until I hear this case. Mm-hmm. That's a possible way that these rules can be removed, and we would revert back to the previous set of rules until they're updated. The other mechanism is you actually go through the full rulemaking process. In other words, changing a rule, whether you're rolling it back or advancing it or doing whatever you're going to do with it, reinstating it, requires that you go through a public process. You propose a rule, you allow public comment, you respond to all those comments, you finalize the rule, and then you can implement it. And that does take a significant amount of time. You know, a new administration would need to prioritize those rules that immediately need to snap back into place or be even better than they were before, because none of these rules were, you know, as I said, rules can always be improved, strengthened, protect the public even more, be more efficient, you know, whatever the improvements are. But it does take time to make those changes. And there is a third mechanism. Congress can stop rulemaking that was made towards the end of an administration. Now, that's a very bad mechanism to use in general, something mm-hmm. called the Congressional Review Act. Mm-hmm. But it is possible. The problem with that is then that Congressional Review Act then prevents any agency from moving forward with similar rulemaking in future on the same issue. So it comes with a lot of problems and isn't really the right way to approach this. The right way to approach it is to go through the process, explain to the public what you're doing, listen to public comments, and then put rules in place that will actually be effective and stand the test of time, as well as court challenges, because they will be challenged in court.
Right.
Well, Andrew, unfortunately, we have to wrap up this conversation, but you've shared so much amazing information with us. Can you tell our listeners where they can find this? What's the best? What are some of the best resources you'd recommend?
The resources on regulatory rollbacks, certainly look at the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards website and the regulations tracker. There's also an important regulations tracker at Harvard Law School environmental program. And we track what we call attacks on science. Union of Concerned Scientists tracks attacks on science on our website. and lists the ways that the Trump administration has sidelined or ignored scientific evidence in making policy. And so those, all three of those are really good resources. If people want to, you know, take action and voice their concerns about these sorts of actions, there's many groups, including ours, and all groups in Coalition for Sensible Safeguards that have different kinds of action alerts, how you can be involved, where you can speak out. And I would say there's lots of opportunity at a local level within communities to and within your states to try to strengthen public health and safety protections, because that's just so important for all of us right now.
Well, Andrew, thanks so much for joining us this morning. We are happy to have you on, and we'll stay in touch. That's Andrew Rosenberg, Director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists, representing the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you very much.